Welcome, everyone, to Undisclosed, Episode 20. Today's sponsors include longtime friend of the show, Stamps.com, and the folks that brought Joey's case to Undisclosed, the Georgia Innocence Project. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
Last week, we began our discussion on the other little blue car and Heath Wilson, the man driving it, that was linked to a different shooting in Rome, not far from, both in time and proximity, Isaac's shooting. There's more to the story, though, and that's the investigation done about the altercation that Heath was in, about when it allegedly happened, and what Heath and his passenger and then girlfriend, Tracy Dunn, had to say about it in court and to the police themselves. Hi, and welcome to episode 20 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Joey Watkins. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And as always, I'm joined with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney with the Volkov Law Group, and I blog at viewfromll2.com.
I'm Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. Around the same time that the British press was spreading misinformation about Napoleon being short, allowing the illusion of truth effect to take root, it spread fake news about the Frenchman's defeat years before he met his Waterloo. This led radical journalist William Cobbett to write a story in an 1807 edition of the Weekly Political Register about how he had used a smoked or red herring as a decoy whose strong scent would deflect hounds chasing after a hare. This itself was a fake story, with Cobbett using it as a metaphor for how the British press was distracted by Napoleon and took their eye off of important domestic issues. But, according to Cobbett, it was a mere transitory effect of the political red herring, for on the Saturday, the scent became as cold as a stone. Although Cobbett's hunting story was false, he kept repeating it, and then his son did the same. As a result, consistent with the illusion of truth effect, people the world over believed that this was an actual hunting practice. Soon, literary critics co-opted the phrase to describe the process of authors such as Sir Arthur Conan Doyle introducing people and information that would distract the reader from the true perpetrator of the crime at hand. Since then, the concept of the red herring is at the heart of pretty much every episode of police procedurals and a key plot device used in movies. And sometimes, in movies like The Usual Suspects, it's the only plot device. Using a red herring, however, is kind of like walking a tightrope. The author needs to first convince the audience that the red herring could have committed the crime, and then convince the audience that the evidence falsely implicating the wrong guy was a case of smoke, but no fire. This is what the state tried to claim in terms of the possible involvement of Heath Wilson in the death of Isaac Dawkins. So, were they successful? At least in the figurative sense, the jury's still out.
Just to refresh your memory, on January 14th, 2000, Heath Wilson was arrested for shooting at a truck owned by a man named David McDaniel after a road rage incident. The event itself allegedly took place a few days earlier, though, on the night of January 11th. Now, David had been trying to get his truck between Heath's car and another car he was harassing, one that was driven by his girlfriend, Ashley Parton. And as they weaved amidst each other on the Alabama highway, what sounded like gunshots were fired. Heath began following David's truck and tailed him all the way to a gas station, the Golden Gallon. Another witness to the altercation, who also heard the gunshot being fired, named Scott Reinhardt, also ended up at the same gas station because he followed Heath there. David apparently got out of his truck holding a tire iron or something of the sort, and it seemed like Heath tried to run him over, but failed, and then he left the parking lot. The last time David McDaniel saw Heath was after they pulled out of the Golden Gallon and got stopped at a red light. Here's what Heath testified to that happened then.
I was in the right lane.
Which lane did he get in?
He was in the left lane.
So he wouldn't have been following you if he was in the lane beside you, would he?
No, ma'am.
And what'd you do?
I opened my car door because my window did not roll down, and I said, what? And he told me, he said, go on. And that's when it was over. I got back in my car as soon as he did that and left.
Heath Keith said that from there he went straight to a friend's house, which was only a third of a mile from the intersection they were at. When they got there, his friend's mother told him to go back to Heath's house and to call 911 from there. In his direct testimony, Heath does mention the 911 calls. It's the only evidence we have, really, about who made those calls or what they were about. But it's only a quick aside brought up on direct, and the prosecution never once mentions those calls in its case.
When you got back and you told somebody about it, you were upset about it?
Yes, sir. I was pretty shook up. I mean, there was a lot of commotion going on. And
you told your mama?
Yes, sir.
And your mama did whatever she did about contacting people, but you didn't do it. Your mama did it. Is that right?
Yes, my mom called 911.
Okay.
Now, from the Sally records in Heath's file, we do know that two 911 calls were made around 8 o'clock p.m., but apparently that was the end of it. Tracy also mentions the 911 calls in her interview with Moser. She says that once they got to the friend's house, quote, we talked to Heath's friend's mom there named Beth, and she told us, we told her what happened, and she told us to go to his mom's house so his mom could call the police. Now, Moser doesn't follow up any on that, but there are a lot of unanswered questions here. Why would Beth tell Heath to go to his mom's house and call 911 there? Why not call 911 right away from her house? Or if nothing else, call his mom from Beth's house and let her know to call 911. Except, call 911 about what? It's hard to imagine what those 911 calls could have been about, because if Heath's mom had actually reported a shooting, 911 should have dispatched an officer out there or noted it in their log somewhere. They didn't. Anyway, according to Heath and Tracy, after these calls, they drove back east on the Alabama Highway to where Heath's grandmother lived, just behind the Walmart, and they spent the rest of the evening watching Who Wants to Be a Millionaire until it was time for Tracy to go home. 3 days later, though, Ashley and David discovered the bullet hole in the back of David's truck. On the evening of January 14th, after filing a police report that morning about the shooting, Ashley saw Tracy and Heath again, this time while she was at work at the Walmart off the Alabama Highway.
What happened the night that you saw them in Walmart? Who did you see in Walmart?
Tracy and Heath Wilson.
Okay.
And there might have been another guy with them. I don't really remember exactly how many people was there.
Do you remember where you were when you saw them?
In electronics.
Okay. And where were they?
Walking by.
Okay. Did you initiate any contact with them or speak to them or anything?
I didn't speak to them.
Okay. Did they initiate any contact with you?
Mm-mm. I just looked up and seen them, and they kept laughing and making faces over there. They walked by two or three times.
They walked by you two or three times?
Well, I was in electronics. They walked by the department two or three times.
Okay. Did you ever see any of them go into the sporting goods department?
I saw them walk into sporting goods, but I didn't follow them.
Okay.
Ashley called her mom, who called the police. Meanwhile, though, while still at Walmart, Heath and Tracy headed over to the sporting goods section, where Heath tried to buy ammo for a 9mm handgun.
A fella came up to the sporting goods register and tried to buy some 9mm shells. Arthur Lynch was waiting on him. I was standing beside Arthur, and he wasn't 21, so Arthur did not sell him the bullets.
So Heath and Tracy left, but they came back a little while later, this time with Heath's friend, Joe Gonzalez.
About 2 to 3 minutes later, a male Hispanic walked up and we sold some 9mm bullets to him. And the party, Mr. Wilson and a girl were standing aside. We looked up and saw them standing there after we had refused to sell them the bullets.
So Heath got the bullets from his friend Joe, and he and Tracy went back to Tracy's place, where later that evening on the 14th, he was arrested. You heard Officer Jesse Adams describe at the end of episode 7 what happened when he picked up Heath that night, about how Tracy had initially brought out the wrong gun, her dad's gun, before, when Jesse Adams challenged her on this, bringing out the 9mm. And you heard about how when Heath was placed in the cop car, he said, "If something happened with that gun, it doesn't belong to me, it belongs to a friend." Well, I should back up for a moment. We're pretty sure all of that happened on January 14th. But the paperwork is kind of a mess. Some of the arrest records say that Heath was arrested instead on the 15th. But we think that's just an error. Like how half the paperwork has the wrong social security number for Heath on it. Or how there are two different incident reports for the Alabama highway shooting with two separate Floyd County Police Department case numbers. So we've got two different police reports with two different case numbers, and both clearly relate to the Alabama Highway, but no idea why they're both filed or who filed them or what's going on.
Just like with the date of Heath's arrest, the paperwork is also unclear about the time that all of this occurred. As many of you pointed out last week in the initial newspaper articles about the Alabama Highway and the 27 South shootings, the Alabama Highway shooting is reported as taking place between 8 and 8:30 p.m., whereas the 27 South shooting was around 7:20. The Rome News Tribune likely got that time from the initial incident report, or investigator Joey Boyd's affidavit for arrest, both of which report the 8 to 8:30 p.m. time.
So it looks like what probably happened is Jerry Boyd received information from Ashley Parton and David McDaniel on January 14th, 2000. I don't know if they came in or called or what, but that information probably conveyed by them was probably that the incident occurred back on January 11th, 2000, sometime between the hours of 8 and 8:30. Why they said that and then later changed to 7 to 7:30 in their written statements, I don't know. Why their written statements appear to be written at home, or at least not at the police department, I don't know that either. It may be that they called or came in. It conveyed what happened to Officer Boyd.
And Jerry Boyd's notes of his interview with David McDaniel, from what appears to be the first time he spoke to David, do have the time 8:30 written down twice, which would explain why the initial arrest warrant said the time of the incident was 8 to 8:30, because that's what David and Ashley said when they came in to report the shooting. But later on, or at least by the time of Heath's trial, all the witnesses agreed with the suggestion that the shooting had happened somewhere around 7:15, 7:25, although David McDaniel doesn't remember exactly how that change came to happen.
So that they're talking to you about times about the other shooting. Do you remember any link between that being like, could your times have been off? You know, you're saying 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock.
I remember a conversation about the way you just said it. I mean, you know, if I mentioned time, they'd say, could there have been a little room for error, or, you know, and I don't know what my response was back then, but I remember, you know, they were asking specifically about time. I remember they actually at one point discussed a little bit about when they were asking about the other individual. They were asking about times, and there were discussion about whether there was enough time, and I don't remember even where the other shooting happened, so this is clearly just what I heard. Like I said, it seemed like it was hush-hush conversation, but they touched on the time. They, you know, were dancing around the times quite a bit.
Here's what still doesn't make sense, though. Even before Ashley and David found the bullet hole and came in to speak to the police, why weren't the police pursuing the shooting themselves? Why did it take for Ashley and David to come in for any investigation into this to get started? Because on January 11th, 2000, Isaac was fatally shot. The police had a major homicide case that they had Rome City and Floyd County swarming all over trying to figure this thing out. And no one thinks to check into the other highway shooting reported to 911 that night? Seriously? Because if the police had just looked at the dispatch logs from that night, they would have seen the report of the blue Honda with possible shots fired. So why didn't anyone check into that? Not to mention, Heath's mother also supposedly reported a highway shooting. So why did no one go out and talk to Heath and Tracy about that? For whatever reason, it didn't happen. On the 14th, most likely, Heath was arrested and charged with 6 counts, 3 of them felonies. The next morning after his arrest, his girlfriend Tracy went to David McDaniel's house to speak to him about the case. She tried to convince him that they had not fired a gun, that it had been the car behind them that had done the shooting. David told her the case was under investigation and that she needed to leave. He never heard from her again. Later that afternoon, Heath was bonded out, and a year and a half later, on July 3rd, 2001, the very next day after Joey was convicted of Isaac's murder, the Floyd County DA arraigned Heath for charges arising from the Alabama highway shooting. The trial date was set a number of times, but because of continuances, Heath didn't go to trial until January 11th, 2002, 2 years after the shooting. After a 3-day trial, he was acquitted on all charges.
With the holidays almost here, you don't have time to go to the post office. It'll be packed with everyone mailing holiday gifts and packages. So use Stamps.com instead. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer. Right now, you can sign up for Stamps.com and use the promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. It's a four-week trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Simply go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in UNDISCLOSED. That's Stamps.com, enter UNDISCLOSED. Now, last week you heard Detective Moser testifying at Heath's trial about how Heath was never a suspect in Isaac's murder. Moser testified at Joey's trial, too, about the timelines for the shootings on the Alabama Highway in 27 South and how they ruled Heath out as a suspect. Although we still don't have audio for that yet because the Floyd County DA is fighting tooth and nail to prevent the audience from being able to hear these witnesses speak for themselves. So we'll have to read it for you. Here's Tammy Colston questioning Detective Moser.
Question. Investigator Moser, did you do anything else other than looking at these times between the Alabama Highway shooting and the Isaac Dawkins first believed to be a wreck but then shooting? Did you do anything else to look to see if there was any connection between the two? Answer, yes. Question, what did you do? Answer, well, I talked with sort of people about this incident, including law enforcement and including one of the witnesses to the incident, and determined the whereabouts of the gentleman involved in the Alabama Highway incident. Where it took place and what the matter of the incident was, what was going on and why it occurred, and then followed up with the time sheets, our time logs to indicate the time difference between the incident on 27 with Mr. Dawkins and the incident on the Alabama Highway, who turned out to be involved in that incident. Question. All right. And what did you learn in your investigation? Answer. That the incident on the Alabama Highway, it was in no way related to the incident on 27 South. Question. Why not? How can you say that with certainty? Answer. By direct testimony, by time evidence, by circumstances regarding or surrounding both of the situations.
When Moser said there was direct testimony that supported his conclusion that Heath was not involved, it seems like he's talking about two witnesses in particular. Tracy Dunn, whom Detective Moser interviewed on January 20th, and Officer Dora Shropshire, who is patrolling that area of West Rome on the night in question. Here's Detective Moser answering Tammy Colston's question about it.
Question. By direct testimony, you are talking about what? Answer. We are talking about a witness that was at the scene, another officer with our agency who was talking to a complainant at 728 at McDonald's about the incident out in the Alabama Highway, and also by time frame distance-wise from Highway 27 South to the Barker Road area. Question. The officer was talking to the complainant and it had just occurred at 728? Answer. An officer was talking to a complainant. I don't know who that person was at 728 at the McDonald's.
Officer Shropshire, who was assigned to West Rome that night, was talking to someone at a McDonald's, and the fact that Officer Shropshire talked to that witness means Heath Wilson couldn't have been on 27 South, and yet Detective Moser never bothered to even learn who that witness was. Seems like an odd choice, and no one from the FCPD bothered to learn who that witness was either while investigating the Alabama Highway shooting. Again, seems very odd. Because the only other place anywhere that this McDonald's thing comes up is from an undated page of Detective Moser's notes that do reference the McDonald's issue briefly. They say, quote, Heath time frame not matching, Dora talking to witness McDonald's during time of incident. Now, the best I can figure, Detective Moser is saying that Dora Shropshire was speaking to a witness to the Alabama Highway shooting at McDonald's at 7:28 p.m., and therefore Heath couldn't have been on 27 South. But so much about this doesn't make any sense. Even aside from the question of who this witness could possibly be and why that witness is totally forgotten, we have other issues. For instance, how could Shropshire have been speaking to a witness to the Alabama Highway shooting at that time? According to the radio logs, at 7:23 p.m., Dora Shropshire was investigating a reported robbery at a bakery off the Alabama Highway. Now, we mentioned that in last week's episode, but what we didn't mention was this. The bakery was directly next to where Tracy Dunn claims the shooting happened. If that shooting happened prior to 7:25, like Moser claims, wouldn't Shropshire have heard it? Or if she didn't hear it, how was she able to catch up to the shooting later? Or if she left the bakery before the shooting, how did a witness find her at the McDonald's when, based on the supposed time of Joey Rhodes' call, the whole chase and altercation with David and Heath would still be going on at that time? Basically, we have a lot of questions and a lot of confusion, but also a lot of reasons to be skeptical about Detective Moser's decision to use this unknown McDonald's witness to exclude Heath Wilson, because none of it makes any sense, and Moser didn't record any details that might allow us to make sense of it. And although we've tried, we can't find Dora Shropshire, so we have no idea whether she knows anything more about what happened at the McDonald's.
At any rate, Moser testified, even aside from the Times making it impossible for Heath to do the both shootings, that there was another reason to think that Heath hadn't done the Highway 27 South shooting. Despite the superficial-sounding similarities, Heath's car actually didn't match the one Wayne Benson had seen that night. Here's Moser's testimony to that effect.
Question. Did you look at Mr. Benson's statement to determine whether or not Heath's car had any similarities to what he told you about? Answer. Yes. Question. And did it have the chrome, fancy chrome wheels that he told you about? Answer. Not that, no. Question. Did he mention an antenna to you on the back of the car? Answer. Yes, he did. Question. Did you see an antenna on the back of Heath's car? Answer. No. Not that I recall, no. Question. Nothing that would call your attention to it. Answer. Nothing that associated the same type of vehicle that Mr. Benson observed there on 27 to associate it with Mr. Wilson's car, no.
Of course, what Moser didn't explicitly mention in his testimony was that he'd also never shown a photo of Heath's car to Benson so that Benson could judge for himself.
I don't think that Joey, back at the time of his trial, really had many thoughts about Heath Wilson and the question of his possible involvement back in the 27 South shooting. There's always been a bunch of theories in this case, and his attorneys back then seemed to waffle mostly between Paul Allen and Joey Boyd to be their quote-unquote real culprits in Isaac's murder. And although Heath was brought up at Joey's trial, it doesn't seem like even the defense really considered him a viable suspect. But there are so many unanswered questions here that need to be answered one way or another before Heath's involvement can be comfortably ruled out.
Over time, as I keep hearing this, and several people have told me about Heath, you know, and, you know, there's an old saying, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And if this guy, you know, this guy was already acting like a lunatic on the road this night and shooting at people, and you know this, I mean, why didn't you look deeper into this guy?
Well, that brings us to our second interview that we had. We talked with Wayne Benson, and Wayne Benson had been given a whole book full of different photographs of different cars that he might have potentially seen that night. And Benson basically says, none of these are the car. You know, we went through the whole interview. He would not allow it to be recorded, but there were three people there. It was me, Susan, and a licensed investigator named Larry Davis. And at the end, we showed him a picture, several color pictures of Heath Wilson's car. And Larry showed them to him, and we're like, you know, I just want to show you these, and let me know if you've seen, you know, if anything strikes you about these cars. And he kind of set it up in a way where he wasn't even suggesting that these were all the same car.
Wayne Benson was very careful in looking over the photos that Larry showed him. The image of the front of the car, he rejected. He noted he'd never seen it from that angle anyway, so it meant nothing to him. But the other photos, the ones that Detective Moser had taken from the rear and from the sides, those caused Mr. Benson to stop. At one point he said, well, this is really close, but it's not the same necessarily because the car I saw had this antenna. But then he kept flipping through and got to a photo of Heath's car that did show the antenna on it. And Mr. Benson got quiet again. Well, he said, that antenna looks like it could be the same after all.
So yeah, the more he looked at it, the more kind of confident he became that that may well have been the car that he saw that night. And then he kind of started getting weird, like we had like tricked him, or, you know, trapped him.
The loophole. He thought we'd found the magic loophole.
That's what he said. That by by getting him to say that's the car, it looks a lot like the car he saw that night. We thought that we had found a way to get you free or something, which was a strange reaction, but point being that kind of just reaffirmed that he felt that that very much could have been the car. And it turns out, I think we've mentioned, I know I've mentioned to you before, that the police never did show him that car. The police never showed Wayne Benson a picture of Heath Wilson's car that night. And we all talked it over afterwards, and we think that probably the reason for that is because Mosier had convinced himself that Heath couldn't have done the shooting because the times were too tight. And so if he believes, if Mosier honestly believes Heath could not have done the shooting, then to have a witness, your only eyewitness, say, well, this is the car I saw, creates bad evidence in Mosier's mind because it can't have been the car. But rather than fully investigating the whole Heath Wilson thing, he just kind of assumed that those times were right. And so that's kind of what we're looking into now.
You know, there are several ways to get from 27 to out by the Kawasaki shop. You know, there are like several roads and several duck offs and several ways. So if I don't know if they timed all of those ways, but there are side roads. There are all kind of roads you can go down. I think it's Floyd Springs. You can go down Bluff Road. You can go down beside the fire station. There are several ways.
There are a lot of possible ways to get from the wreck site in 27 South to back up again to the Kawasaki shop on the Alabama Highway. But not too long ago, a new bypass was put in, and the most direct route is probably a lot quicker now, or at least it'd be quicker for someone who drives at a normal speed on back roads, and not someone who would be driving stupidly like Heath seems to have been doing that night. So there's no possible way to try and recreate the drive now, and we thought for a long time that no one from the state had tried to do so either, back then. When Claire and I spoke to Jerry Boyd, who was the lead investigator from the Floyd County Police Department on the Alabama Highway shooting, he told us that he didn't think Heath had anything to do with Isaac Dawkins' murder. But he did seem to think Heath had done the Alabama Highway shooting, and said that Heath's problem had been that the people he'd been shooting at turned out to know him. Though, Jerry Boyd also mentioned, he'd caught hell from Heath's mama for pursuing the case against Heath in that shooting. Still, Jerry Boyd said, even though he didn't think Heath had been involved in the mess in 27 South, as for whether or not the drive between Highway 27 and the Alabama Highway could have been done, well, he didn't know all the details of it, but the way he'd heard it, yeah, it could be. He wouldn't tell us who had done the drive test. He said he didn't want to give us a name and then turn out to be wrong about it if his memory was off. But as he recalled, another officer had done the drive, had timed it, and done it within the time allowed.
Detective Mosier, who was from the Rome police, though, thought the opposite. Here's what he testified to at Joey's trial.
Question: have you had experience in driving from this area where this, the Kawasaki shop, and out to Highway 27 in the area where Isaac Dawkins went off the road before? Answer: yes. Question: and is it physically possible to make it in the time between the 20 West, the Isaac Dawkins shooting, and the West shooting? Answer: in my opinion, by no means. It takes me an average of 15 minutes. There again you have, as you know, it seems like Rome has 5,000 red lights and you have about 4,000 of them going down Shorter Avenue and Turner McCall.
But what Mosier is describing isn't the right route. That's if you're going the slow way around, east through downtown Rome. There's another route, one that may not have had any red lights at all. That route takes you west along the back roads and down to Walker Mountain. As for how long it would take, well, the roads have changed so much there now that it's not really possible to do an accurate recreation. Like Susan mentioned, there's a bypass in place now, and the route has changed entirely. Still, I think even under the best of conditions and with the stupidest of driving, it would take at least 10 minutes, which doesn't fit with the handwritten records from the Rome Floyd E911. And although the defense tried to impeach the reliability of those records at trial, we don't think the defense won that battle. This is from Joey's trial, with Rex Abernathy cross-examining Floyd County Police Chief Bill Shiflett.
Question: do you recall a couple of weeks ago when I was over there looking for the records? Answer: yes, sir. Question. And you recall what was the young lady's name at 911 that came in looking for the Floyd County Police Department cards that were missing? Answer, Jennifer Conway. Question. Jennifer Conway? And you recall I went out to where they keep these records looking for the originals and they told me they didn't have them. Do you recall when I was over at the office looking for these records? Answer, sure. Yes, sir. Question. And you recall you all telling me that Stanley Sutton had the original cards? Answer, no, sir. I didn't tell you that. Question. Did you talk to Ms. Conway over at 911? Answer, I did. Question. All right. And when you and her had the conversation, did you receive information that the Floyd County Police Department 911 cards were missing and they didn't have them at 911? Answer. She told me that the original whole box for the day was missing and that she couldn't find them and she didn't know where they were. And we had copies of it, but not the originals. Question. And pursuant to that information, did you go out to the records and check out there? Answer. Did I? No, sir, I didn't. Question. Did Mr. Sutton go? Answer. I don't think so. The only one that ever went to the records was you that I know of. We checked the logs to see who has been out there, and you were the only one that had been there, so that is all I know.
This bit of testimony seems familiar in that something very similar happened to Claire a year ago when she was trying to get records from the Floyd County Police Department. Sutton's notes had gone missing again, and when Claire tried to find out where the missing files were, she was told that the only person to have been in possession of them was, well, her. The missing files turned up again eventually, and no, Claire did not have them, but Chief Shiflett's insinuation at Joey's trial that the only one who'd accessed the 911 records was Joey's attorney sounds familiar. And then there's this. Jennifer Conway, the 911 dispatcher who told the defense and the Floyd County officers that the box of 911 records was missing, was very helpful when Claire had questions for her and volunteered her time to help with reconstructing the 911 procedures that were in place back in 2000. But she also made no secret that she had her own opinions on Joey's case.
I spoke to four witnesses on Tuesday and also Jennifer Conway. And Jennifer was helpful explaining it all to me, and she was the one who told me about the Sally printout, and she was going to help me decipher it. We're talking and blah blah. We talked for quite a while, and then she says, "You know, I need to see it. I need to see it to be able to figure it out because those numbers aren't making sense to me right now." So I took a picture of it and I texted it to her, and she probably responded about less than 5 minutes later. And her response was, the call came in on line one. Mm-hmm. This is the three-letter code that indicates the trunk line. Mm-hmm. Anywho, good luck in your search. I personally hope Joey Watkins rots in prison. Which is a very strong feeling to have 15 years after the case, in fact, when you weren't connected with the case.
Jennifer Conway is married to a Floyd County police officer who had investigated Joey's case, so we can only guess that's where her strong feelings come from. But those sorts of small-town connections make it hard not to wonder, is it possible Jennifer Conway could have tried a little harder to find the 911 dispatch records if she hadn't wanted Joey to rot in prison? On the other hand, she went out of her way to help Claire understand the 911 records when she didn't have to. However it is the box became unavailable or wasn't found, the defense did bring up the missing records in its closing arguments. Here's what Rex Abernathy told the jury.
It is very troubling to me. It is very troubling to me that they would come in here and Mr. Sutton would not take the stand and answer questions about all these telephone records, all these 911 records, and all these logs, and all these things. It is troubling. It is troubling to me, and this is the last time, ladies and gentlemen, the last time anyone is ever going to get to talk to you about Joey Watkins.
In Colston's closing, though, she stressed that the defense's harping on the missing 911 records was just a ploy that the jury shouldn't give in to. Sure, there are not Floyd County dispatch cards for, say, Isaac's wreck, and sure, the entire box of records is missing, but don't listen to defense counsel. Those records probably just don't exist in the first place.
Now, he made a big to-do about some missing cards from the county. I want to ask you something. Why would there be a county car to begin with? This wreck happened in the city. They dispatched a call in the log and then said 1022, which means disregard. There is nobody hiding anything. It is a red herring. It is a smokescreen. It is designed to divert your attention from the truth of this case.
So the prosecutor argued that the fact that the defense brought up the missing evidence was an attempt to mislead the jury from the truth, and that there was no evidence to support that the missing evidence meant anything. But the state's failure to secure basic records meant it was impossible to ever reconstruct an accurate timeline. And according to Tammy Colston, if the defendant points out that there are critical missing records, it's because he's guilty and wants to confuse you. In fact, in a different part of her closing, Tammy Colston made essentially the exact same point about the defense's decision to even bring up the Heath Wilson issue at all.
The Alabama highway shooting, after we showed that that was something that was looked at from the get-go, and the officers talked to the people involved and compared the bullets to the gun used in the Alabama highway shooting, and drove the route and found out it was totally impossible to get from Kawasaki shop to where it happened in the 5 minutes remaining, and you will see that on the logs too, from the Kawasaki shop to there. Did you hear them say anything else about the Alabama highway shooting? Let me explain something. It is something you don't have to be a lawyer to understand, and I think you probably already understand it. It is called a smokescreen, a red herring, something that they throw out to try and divert your attention from the facts of this case.
Hello, listeners of Undisclosed. This season, you've heard a lot from Claire at the Georgia Innocence Project. She did a huge amount of the groundwork for us in bringing you Joey's story. Another GIP legal fellow, Rick Latta, gave everything he had to revive this case after it had lain dormant for years. That includes driving across the state of Georgia to Rome almost every week, sometimes several times a week, to reinvestigate events that few people wanted to talk about. They created a great foundation for our Undisclosed Investigation and podcast and have been invaluable help to us throughout this season. Now we're asking you to help them. Help them raise enough money to hire another attorney to work through their cases. Join the thousands of other people who have sent in $5 or more, and in doing so, in less than a month, raised over $30,000 for this very worthy organization by texting the word Joey to 91999 right now and donating just $5. You'll help them get to their $50,000 goal by the end of the year. And you'll get the satisfaction of knowing that your money went to help exonerate those who are sitting in prison for a crime that they did not commit. Right now, you can do it. Pick up that phone and text Joey to 91999 to donate $5 and demonstrate your support for the work of the Georgia Innocence Project. One more time, listeners, that's Joey. Text it to 91999 to give to Claire, Rick, and the other good folks down at the Georgia Innocence Project to help them overturn wrongful convictions.
As much as we want to find those dispatch records, and as much as we suspect the full records from the night of January 11th would go a long way to telling us what really happened in the case, I think the search for them has gone as far as it can go. Because if that missing box of records was found again after Joey's trial, it would no longer exist now anyway. In search of any scrap that could be found about the dispatch records' fate, Claire spoke to Greg Helms at the Floyd County Retention Center.
There's no law in the state of Georgia says how long you have to keep a record. The only thing is that the records have to be so they have public access as long as they are kept. The Georgia Archives goes through and they compare the laws that connect to those records. How long are they needed for legal purposes? And then that's how they set their retention periods.
Okay.
And it's a group including the Attorney General and all of those that get together.
So we're basically in a humongous warehouse mm-hmm. with just rows and rows and rows and rows and rows of shelving going up to the very tall ceiling with totally organized boxes, all the same, all on shelves, all clearly numbered. And this is where you store all those.
This is where we store all those records. All the records that are sent to us get stored in this building.
Stored, that is, until the retention period is over and the records are scheduled for destruction. 911 dispatch cards and radio logs have a 6-year retention schedule, which means if everything went as it was supposed to, all those records were destroyed back in 2006, and a destruction notice would have been made documenting that. Now the destruction notices themselves have a 7-year retention schedule, which means the notice that the dispatch records had been destroyed would itself be destroyed in 2013. So that's not available either.
So we don't even know at this point, since the destruction notices have been destroyed, whether the box was here and destroyed. There is a chance it had been checked out and not returned?
There may have been a chance that a lot of times they didn't check out the whole box. They would check out the cards.
I see.
And so it was either the box or the cards. Well, if they checked out the cards, there may have been 2 or 3 cards on that incident as that came in, the calls that came into 911 about that incident. Well, I don't know where, you know, they would have had to send the cards back and we would put them back in the box. So a lot of times that's what she would do at that time. She would order just the cards.
I see.
Instead, then boxes were heavy. They were a low to carry back and forth.
So she being Jennifer Conway at 911.
So at this point, our only hope of finding them is if they were checked out once long ago and somehow never found their way back into the box. And even under the very slim odds something like that did happen, that doesn't give us any direction on where to look for it now. So setting aside the question of when all this happened, what else do we know about the Alabama highway shooting? Moser testified at Joey's trial that he talked to 2 witnesses about it. One was Officer Dora Shropshire, who supposedly talked to an unknown witness to the Alabama highway shooting. The other was Tracy Dunn, Heath's girlfriend, who was 16 at the time. That interview, at least, was recorded, and while we don't have the audio, we do have a transcript. Tracy told Moser that Heath had borrowed the gun from a friend at work, some guy named Barry, but he'd only gotten it on the same day that he was arrested, and that's why he'd been at the Walmart buying ammo for it. That was the first and only day she'd ever seen Heath with a gun. When Detective Moser asked her if she'd been out on the Alabama highway at about 8:30 p.m., she corrects him. No, she said, it was about 7:15 p.m.
It was about right in there, and Heath, he got in the turning lane. Yes, it was wrong, but that's beside the point. Okay, he got in the turning lane, and he started passing people in the turning lane, and the girl of the, she was in the green Cavalier, a new one. Her name is Ashley. She got in front of us and slammed her brakes on, so he slowed down. She got back over, and we passed her. Back going down a little bit, and we ended up getting behind her again, and Heath was kind of riding up behind her car, and she was slamming on her brakes and flipping us off, and it was going back and forth like that. And then right there between, like, around the Tannin Zone and the cemetery and all that, we heard 2 gunshots come from behind us. Me and Heath thought it was somebody probably shooting up in the air to get everybody to quit, to get us to quit fighting, and, you know, all that junk. And we thought they were shooting up in the air. Me and Heath didn't know what was going on. And we kept going down the road, and she eventually, we was in the right lane when that happened, when the gun was shot in the right lane. And when we got to the red light, right there at the gas station where the Kroger is, we stopped right there, and Heath opened the door and threw his hands, and she kept going straight, holding onto the wheel, going straight, and she didn't look away, and then the light turned green.
They kept driving up to Redmond Circle and went to the Golden Gallon where they had had the altercation with a semi-driver before finally driving away again.
So we turned right at a Golden Gallon right beside CVS, and Heath opened his door to David, and he was in his truck and threw up his hands like, you know, what or whatever, and David shook his head no and locked his door. And that's when we went over to his friend's house.
Tracy said they went to Heath's friend's place, quote, about 5 till 8 or 8 o'clock, between 5 till 8 and about 10 after 8, somewhere around in there. But that can't be right. Heath's friend lived only 1/3 mile from where they last saw David, which means they would have been there right after the Alabama highway altercation ended. And the whole drive from the Kawasaki to Bess would only take 6 to 10 minutes, depending on how much time the little stop at the Golden Gallon took. If Tracy is right about them being at Heath's friend's place at 8 o'clock p.m., it changes everything, because it means that the whole thing took place about 1/2 hour later than the state claims.
And Tracy was never interviewed again, and wasn't called as a witness at Heath's trial, so she never gave another statement after her January 20th, 2000 interview with Moser. We were really interested in hearing from her now. What did she remember about that night? Could she corroborate the story Heath gave at his trial? So back over the summer, Claire and Amy from the Georgia Innocence Project went up to Tracy's house north of Atlanta and spoke to her. On the drive back, they called me to give me an update on how it had gone.
Okay, so we showed up in
her neighborhood. We knocked and she answered right away. She had two big dogs and she came outside on the front porch, and it's been, like I said, 101 degrees today. And it was about, 4:30 or 5, mm-hmm. 5 o'clock, and the sun was beating down on that front door, and we stood out there, no shade, with the reflection of the front door for 45 minutes. Everyone was just dripping sweat. It was really gross. And she seemed very friendly. Like, she came out, like, hi, how are you? Like, she didn't know who we were, but she was very nice and chatty. And so we told her we're from the Georgia Innocence Project and gave her background.
First, she didn't seem to have any idea of what we were talking about. Nothing clicked with her. And then Claire started talking about that somebody had been shot. And then she goes, I was in the car with that boy. And I said, Heath Wilson? She goes, yes, Heath. And that's when she started remembering about the her part of the story. But nothing about Joey's story really clicked with her. As far as her remembering, oh yeah, I remember that incident.
Right. And we were both a little bit shocked by that, because we thought that she would immediately remember, but she claims to not know much at all, if anything, about the Highway 27 shooting.
Tracy told them that she'd never heard anything about the Highway 27 shooting. It was just the Alabama Highway shooting she knew about, and that's because she was present for it.
She immediately started by telling us that they were the ones who were shot at that night. She and Heath were. And that she told us Heath did not have a gun, and then she said the only gun he had was my daddy's gun when he was arrested that night. So that's not true, and
right.
She probably knows that's not true. So that,
and we came back to that.
And when we came back to it, she, you know, we just said, well, you know, we know that he was arrested with a 9mm, and she was like, yeah. So I don't know if it's that she was making an intentional misstatement or just misremembered.
Tracy did remember a rough sequence of events about what happened that night.
So her story basically was that she was with Heath that night. She thinks that she may have been at Heath's mom's house by herself without Heath, and that would not have been unusual, and that Heath came and picked her up at his mom's house. She said that they went from there onto Alabama Highway. Then she said that the windows in the car did not roll down, and they had heard, two shots?
Well, she said that she heard a gunshot. And I asked her, did you hear the gunshot with the windows up? And I think that made her a little bit wary. And then when I asked, well, weren't you scared when you heard the gunshot? Then she's like, well, should I get a lawyer? And so Claire was managed to back her down at that point. But I don't know that she... Because Claire asked her, she said, you said in your statement you heard two shots. And she said, yeah, that's probably right. I don't remember. But what she said about the windows was that they were the roll, you know, you had to manually roll down the windows, and that they didn't even have the handles to roll down. And then late in the conversation, Claire said, well, some witness saw the passenger arm out the window, and she didn't have anything to say about that.
And she was explaining, like, how could Heath have shot anybody? You know, the windows didn't even roll down. We didn't have a gun that night. He didn't have a gun that night. She didn't see him with a gun until that night when he was at her dad's house.
And she said she never saw him with a gun except that one night at her dad's house.
That bit about the car window not rolling down is strange, though, because like Claire told Tracy, there was a witness, Scott Reinhart, who testified that he saw a hand out the passenger window at the time he heard the shot, which doesn't make a lot of sense if the passenger window was broken. And although Heath did testify at his trial on cross-examination in a sort of throwaway manner that his window had been broken and couldn't roll down, like he heard at the beginning of the episode when he was describing what happened after the Golden Gallon, that's the only time it's ever brought up. Because if this was true, if Heath's window really couldn't roll down, then why wasn't that a central feature of the defense's case? Why did it only come up on cross-examination without any supporting facts or testimony? Because Heath's defense attorney put together a strong case, given what he had to work with, and he seemed prepared for the trial and more than competent. So why would he have ignored this crucial detail about the driver's window being broken like Heath claimed? Why wouldn't he have raised it as proof that no, Heath couldn't have done the shooting because he couldn't have even opened his window? As for the passenger side window, well, Tracy's statement to Amy and Claire is the first and only time that I've seen that claim come up. And it directly contradicts the testimony from Scott Reinhart.
During that split second when you heard the sounds, you saw the passenger on the erratic side in the erratic driver's car with a hand out the window. And that's the split second when you heard the pop pop.
Okay.
Maybe Scott was wrong about seeing the hand, but it still doesn't explain why Heath's attorney never tried to challenge this at trial. Anyway, whether the window or windows worked or not, according to Tracy, there wasn't any gun that night, or at least there wasn't any gun in their car. Another driver that night had had a gun and tried to shoot them, or maybe tried to shoot someone else, and they got in the way of some kind of fight or another. But it hadn't been them shooting. It was someone else shooting either at them or at someone around them.
She kept talking about somebody's father being mad and driving a semi. I assume it's the semi that pulled in behind them, but I don't know what you're talking about.
She seemed to have a sense that Ashley Carton's father drove a semi, which he did, but that he was also on the road that night. But I think she's mixing it up with Ashley Carton's father's friend who was on the road that night. But she was like, we actually thought that maybe we got caught in the crossfire of some like family dispute that was going on. That was her kind of explanation for what was going through their head, because she's adamant that they did not do the shooting, that Heath did not shoot anyone that night.
And this isn't the only time that Tracy seems to have suggested there was some kind of family feud going on. I've talked to other people in the case and who knew Tracy, and according to them, it wasn't Ashley's family that Tracy suggested had been involved. It was members of David McDaniel's family who may have been involved somehow. But she's always maintained that it was she and Heath that were endangered by the shooting, and that the cops were so focused on Heath as a possible suspect that they never even cared about that she and Heath had been shot at that night. And Tracy is adamant that Heath had nothing to do with any shooting, on the Alabama highway or otherwise.
And she was like, if he did, I don't know anything about it, and it was certainly not when I was in the car. Like, he did not tell me anything about that. He wouldn't have told me anything about that. And I can tell you, when I was in the car with him, nothing like that happened. We were on Alabama Highway, and there was not a gun in the car.
And he didn't act sketchy when he came to pick her up. She said he's not that kind of guy. You know, that she said he's got himself into a lot of trouble. He ran with a bad crowd, but she would not have thought him capable of murder.
And I asked her, I said, you know, he clearly has meth problem. Did he have a meth problem then? And she basically said yes.
Yes.
And I said, well, could it be that it's not so much his personality that might lead to that, as, you know, on some kind of crazy meth high with a bit of a rage problem and a gun that you shoot off accidentally? And she didn't totally disregard that, but it wasn't like, it was kind of like, it's not beyond the realm of possibility, but it's not like she knew anything about that. Like, I honestly believe that if Heath was involved, she had absolutely nothing to, she was not also in the car.
Overall, Clara thought that if Heath was still a potential suspect, he had to have done it at a time when Tracy wasn't around. As for what happened after the shooting on the Alabama highway, well, I had managed to convince myself that Tracy would at least be able to resolve the question of the 911 calls from Heath's house that night. After all, in her interview with Moser, she'd referenced them and talked about how the police had been called. So she'd for sure known about the calls, at least back then. And after Amy and Claire spoke to her, I was excited to hear their update on what those 911 calls had been all about in the first place.
She had no recollection of calling 911.
God damn it.
And in fact, she said she also doesn't have a distinct memory of going over to Beth's house after this incident, but said it wouldn't surprise her at all because they went over there a lot.
So, no luck there on the 911 calls. Tracy was a credible witness, though, and 16 years ago, her memory on these points undoubtedly would have been a lot better. She would have made a good witness at Heath's trial, which is kind of strange in itself because Heath's attorney decided not to call her as a witness.
If he's got her statement, then her statement says they didn't do it, so why wouldn't he call her to testify? It's not like he rolled over on this case. I mean, he fought it and won. Maybe he knew the family and didn't want to bring her into it or something.
I don't know.
But he didn't call any of the alibis as a witness.
Prior to trial, Heath did send in a list of 8 defense witnesses with Tracy first on it, but no one on the list was called. For some of those witnesses, it's obvious why Heath had listed them. But there are a few names on it we don't recognize, and one in particular has always stood out to me. It lists a name, Bridget, and no home address. Instead, it gives a work address, Golden Gallon, 3070 Cedartown Highway. A Golden Gallon was involved in the Alabama highway shooting, so maybe that's what this is here for. Maybe that's what Bridget could have been a witness to. But what stands out to me is that the Golden Gallon listed on this defense list, it's not the Golden Gallon near the Alabama Highway. It's the Golden Gallon directly across from the entrance to Floyd College, where Isaac would have been pulling out onto 27 South the night he was shot. But then again, maybe that's just where Bridget was working at the time of the trial, and it's just a coincidence that it's the one near where Isaac had been that night. Unfortunately, although I've tried leaving messages for Bridget and some of her family members, I haven't heard back, and at this point, I have to assume it's just a coincidence. Still, I'd like to know why exactly Heath wanted to list her as a witness for the defense, and where she'd been working back in January of 2000.
The only witness the defense ended up calling at Heath's trial was Heath himself.
On January the 11th, let's start, say, around 6:30 or so, where were you in the evening?
About 6:30, I was leaving my mom's house because they were going to Las Patales State.
Okay, and your mom lives where?
Off Alabama Highway on Pinecrest. It's right before you get to Coos High School.
Okay, and is this the same Pinecrest Street that Mr. Joey Rhodes, who testified, lives on?
Yes, sir.
Do you know Mr. Rhodes?
No, sir.
Okay. Does he live near you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You left your mom's residence, and where did you go? Let's talk about your route. Tell me where you first went.
Well, we first went over to my girlfriend's house.
And where did she live?
It's on Burnett Ferry.
Okay.
And we stayed over at her house. We ate supper. We were waiting on my parents to get back home from Los Patales. And we left her house, went back to my mom's house.
Okay, so you went back out to the Coosa area?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and you know what time it was?
Probably about 7:15.
Okay. So you get out there and what happens?
Mom wasn't home yet.
Okay. So what do you do?
We turn around and left. We just went riding around. Thought about going to Santa Friend and Garden Lakes. Okay.
So Heath and Tracy headed east toward town, but at some point they ran into Ashley and things got a little tense between the two cars.
I was traveling at a higher rate of speed than everybody else. And I was speeding and I come up behind her. And when I did, she hit her brakes on me. And I got kind of upset, and I got over, and I was going to try to pass her in the turning lane. And when I did, she swerved over in the turning lane and hit her brakes. And I got a little more upset, and we were going back and forth, and she was shooting me birds, I was shooting her birds. I mean, we were antagonizing it one just as much as the other.
According to Heath, it was a little while after his first encounter with Ashley that the shots were fired.
At any time, did y'all get in front of the 18-wheeler?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And about where was that?
It was about at the Kawasaki shop.
Okay. At that point in time, did you hear anything unusual?
Yes, sir.
And what did you hear?
I heard one gunshot, or what I thought was a gunshot at the time.
Okay.
And I cut my radio all the way down. And as soon as I did, I heard another one. And I thought someone was shooting at me.
Okay, where were you?
I was a little past the Kawasaki shop, maybe 4 seconds, doing 55 miles an hour past it.
Okay. And where was Tracy?
Ashley. She was in front of me.
Despite the gunshots, Heath was still mad and unwilling to give up his argument with Ashley. Shortly after the shooting, when they hit a red light across from the Texaco station, he got out and confronted Ashley.
Did you stop at the red light? Did everybody stop?
Everybody stopped.
Did you get out of your vehicle?
Yes, sir, I did.
And what did you do?
I stepped out of my vehicle and asked her what her problem was.
Okay, did you use choice words?
They weren't very choice.
Well, they were rude,
yes, sir.
So you got back in the car and you go up, and let's get back to where we were. David and you are Yan from Sam's Club around to the Golden Galley.
Yes, sir.
Is that an accurate statement?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
After a 3-day trial, Heath was found not guilty on all counts arising from the Alabama highway shooting. Without talking to the jury, we can never know why they decided the way they did, but Greg Price, Heath's attorney, was able to raise a strong defense on the basis of a number of inconsistencies in the state's case. Because he was right. There were a lot of things in the state's case against Heath that didn't make a lot of sense. For instance, the testimony from Joy Rhodes in the 911 call that he made was a mess.
They rehabilitated or tried to rehabilitate Mr. Rhodes by bringing in the 911 lady, Dan Collins' wife, Cindy Collins, to testify about the 911 sheet that they had. But and they're saying, well, that's consistent. He was talking on the phone, therefore he said they wrote Kawasaki on the 911 sheet. But you know what's more important about that? Remember all the conflicts that Ms. Collins said? She said that Mr. Rhodes said that they were chasing him, that he was trying to avoid them, to evade them, or something was the word, and that there were 3 or 4 shots. Is that a conflict? Yeah, it's a conflict. Does that corroborate and rehabilitate Mr. Rhodes? No. Mr. Rhodes said it was about 1,000 feet back. First, he says it was a rail track. Then he says that they rehabilitated and said it's a Kawasaki place. I ask him, are you telling the truth today? I guess I should have gone on and said about what you testified to today. And he said, yeah, I'm telling the truth. So if he's telling the truth today about the Kawasaki shop, what's the Kawasaki notation on the 911? Why the conflict and what he says happened and what 911 says that he told them?
It's not just 911 that Joy Rhodes' story conflicts with. In fact, there's not really a single part of the state's case that remains consistent across all the witnesses, because Joy Rhodes' story just doesn't match with what anyone else described.
Over here, we've got Ashley, Heath, and Mr. Rhodes. Mr. Rhodes didn't even recall the pickup truck. He didn't even have a pickup truck in the scenario. If you'll recall, he also said that he was immediately behind Heath Wilson, or as he called him, the erratic driver.
And if Rhodes was behind Heath, then how could Scott Reinhart also be behind Heath? There are other problems, too. Joe Rhodes couldn't remember where exactly the shot occurred and couldn't remember seeing Heath interacting with other cars that night. He said Heath was in the left lane when the shots occurred, when all the other witnesses say it was the right. He testifies that all the cars just got out of Heath's way, there was no chasing of Ashley. In fact, the only interaction Rhodes saw between Heath's Honda and another car was a curious event that literally no other witness ever saw happen.
You saw a car pull into a service station?
Yeah.
And then the crazy driver pull in behind it?
Yes.
Okay. The only service station I can recall between the Barker Road railroad tracks and the Coosawattie that I can think of, and you correct me if I'm wrong, would be that used to be a favorite market, now it's a Texaco right there at Huff Acre. Is that the one that they pulled into?
Yes, sir.
Let's talk about that for a second. Now, can you describe the car that pulled in first?
I think I can't describe the car, but it was a white car.
A white car.
I'm pretty sure.
Was it a GM big road boat, or was it a
No, I think it was a small kind of car. Small car.
Import.
Yeah.
Okay, and then the crazy driver pulled in behind it,
yeah.
Or in front of it, or
behind it, and then the white car pulled back out. So then the Honda pulled back out too.
Okay. So we're talking about, did that person try to get up, the white car, did it try to get up to the store and get out and go in the store? Did you see
that? I think they was just trying to turn off the highway because they didn't, they was just trying to get out of the way of the people.
Okay.
And then they pulled off.
Now, I'm going to describe, and you tell me if it's wrong. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth.
Yes, sir.
The white car pulls into the Favorite Market. Does it stop at the pump area, or does it just keep on going through?
I think I'm pretty sure it keeps on going through. It
and
just
then
pulls around.
It whips around and goes back out on the road.
Yeah.
Okay. Now the crazy driver pulls in behind it and pretty much follows that same path.
Yes.
Okay.
What Rhodes was describing was not the Golden Gallon incident. Rhodes never saw that part. It was at the end of everything, 3 miles away, and after Rhodes had gone off in a different direction from everyone else in the case. But Ashley Parton, David McDaniel, Scott Reinhart, Heath Wilson, and Tracy Dunn all agree no one pulled into the Texaco like Joey Rhodes describes. They also agree there were no little white cars involved in any of this. All of them describe instead some variation of seeing Ashley merge into the center turning lane to turn towards the Texaco. But then Heath pulled into the turning lane behind her, causing her to merge back right and continue along the Alabama Highway. So did Joey Rhodes really see the same event that everyone else did? Or could he have just misremembered a gas station chase scene that never occurred? It wasn't just the conflicts between the witnesses that helped the defense case, though. The confusing mess of claims about the forensics or lack thereof also helped to jumble matters, like the decision to impound Heath's car, apparently for GSR testing. Detective Moser from the Rome Police Department and lead investigator on the 27 South case said he had nothing to do with any of that.
I didn't have anything to do with towing or requesting that vehicle be impounded.
Well, I'm just asking you, were you familiar with the fact that it was being impounded, for instance?
After it was impounded, yes.
And the forensics that was being that was going to be done on the vehicle would relate to firearms?
Oh, let me back up. I wasn't familiar why it was impounded as far as the forensic part.
Okay.
I had nothing to do with that, wasn't told with that, and be honest with you, it wasn't part of my investigation at that point. So I don't have an answer for you.
Okay. So you did not, but you don't know if anyone else in the joint cooperative investigation would have ordered a forensics exam for powder burns on that vehicle?
No, sir, I don't know. It was not part of mine, and I'll go ahead and add this. The only thing I did with this vehicle is took a picture of it.
Okay. Let me ask you, in your experience over the years as an investigator, there is a procedure by which you can ascertain whether or not there are flash marks or burn marks or powder burns, as we layperson would call it, by using certain tests. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And in fact, certain cartridges have, in cooperation with the FBI, certain what we call rare earth items like antimony and even arsenic added to the particular powder, so there can be some identifying tracers. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, by each individual, if you will, manufacturer of that cartridge.
Okay. And what is expelled from a revolver, let's use a revolver, has a discharge that not only comes from the end of the barrel, but also from any other crevice that's available for the powder to discharge from.
That's correct.
And that's usually why they do hand swabs and things like that.
Yeah, blowback from the cylinder on a revolver, the cylinder or the round thing, it will expel from there also.
Okay.
And Jerry Boyd, from the Floyd County Police Department and lead investigator on the Alabama Highway case, said that he had nothing to do with it either.
Now, there are forensics tests that can be done to determine lead from bullet shots.
Yes.
But that was not ordered in this case.
No, sir.
And there are tests that can determine for the purposes of finding powder.
Yes, sir.
On vehicles if a gunsman shot outside of a window of a vehicle.
Yes, sir.
In fact, they did that in the Dawkins case, didn't they?
I don't know. I didn't have anything to do with that case.
In fact, they did that and they impounded his vehicle for 2 weeks to have that done, didn't they?
I can't say. I don't know, sir.
But you know that there were no, during the time period that he didn't have his car, You don't know of any tests that were done on
him? No, sir, I don't.
To the best of your knowledge, there were no tests done.
As far as I know, there wouldn't.
Nobody took the time to do any tests on the bullet, alleged bullet hole in the back of the pickup or the gray Honda for powder burns to determine whether or not he was telling the truth when he said he didn't do it.
No, sir, there was.
What we have is the word of the two teenage people that said that he's the one that did it. They knew him, and he was the one.
Yes, sir.
Now, it's possible the defense attorney, Greg Price, was just throwing shade everywhere here, that he had no idea of any forensic testing that was being done, and that he was just basing his questioning off of what his client told him, because Heath said he was told that GSR testing was done.
How long did they keep your vehicle before they released it to you?
It was about 13 or 14 days.
Okay. And what was your understanding as to why they kept it so long?
Because they said they had to run powder tests on the side of it to see if I was the one that shot the gun on the Alabama highway that night.
It's not that I'm inclined to take Heath at his word here, but on the other hand, why would Heath lie about this? If it really didn't happen, what possible benefit is there to him in making it up? That's what I struggle with here, because this lie wouldn't be strategic, it wouldn't be helpful, and at best, it would risk undermining his credibility in front of the jury, just when he needed it the most. And also, seriously, why didn't the cops do GSR testing here on Heath's Honda? We know that the Rome Police Department took swabs of Isaac's hands for GSR testing while in the hospital, but they forgot to take that into the lab for testing, or even to log it into evidence. It only turned up in 2014 when Rick Lotta from the Georgia Innocence Project went to review evidence, and when he found it, it hadn't been sent in for testing at all. It was just stuffed in the back of a three-ring binder and forgotten. Is it possible that something like that here happened with the GSR testing from Heath Sonda?
There are also other things that Heath claims happened that the investigators say didn't, like his interrogation on the night of the arrest.
How many investigators actually talked with you that night?
There were three in the room throughout the night.
And how long did they talk with you?
About 2.5 hours.
Okay. Did they ask you to sign a waiver so that you would talk with them and release your rights under Miranda?
Yes, sir.
And did you sign that?
Yes, sir.
And did you talk with them?
Yeah.
And did you deny the fact that you shot at Ashley Parton and David McDaniel?
Yes, sir, I did.
Okay. They talked to you about the Dawkins case, too, didn't they?
That was the most of the conversation.
Okay. Did you ever have a transcript made of your interview, or do you know if there was one made?
No, sir. I was told that...
Well, don't say what you was told. Did you ever see an interview transcript?
No, sir.
So you don't know whether or not they recorded your statement or not?
Not really. I know...
Was there a tape recorder?
There was a tape recorder on the desk, and they pressed a button on it, but...
Do you know if it worked or not?
No, sir. I have no way of proving whether
it worked. You've not seen a tape or a transcript since then, have you?
No, sir.
Again, why would Heath lie about this? If it's untrue, he has to know there are now three police officers who can impeach him, who will testify that he was lying, that there was no interrogation, and no recording, which is exactly what happened.
Patrol Division Officer Jesse Adams had brought him, Mr. Wilson, into the station. And Investigator Boyd was off duty, talked to him on the phone, and he asked us to follow up on his investigation.
Did you actually meet with Mr. Wilson?
Yes.
Okay. And at the time that you met with him, did you have, about how long did your entire meeting with him take place?
I would say 15, 20 minutes, 30 minutes at the most.
All right. And when you met with him, was there any sort of a tape recorded interview or a lengthy interview of any kind done with him?
No.
Why not?
Like I said, when we got to the station, the patrol officer already had him there. We went in, myself and Investigator Stewart introduced myself, read him his rights, and talked to him briefly, asked him if he knew anything about the incident. He denied it. We talked a few more minutes. He just denied having any knowledge of the incident, so there was nothing to record or no further action to be taken at that time.
I've got to say, it's really hard not to believe Heath on this one. And hard to believe there wasn't an interrogation. Because Heath was already charged in an aggravated assault case, and certainly had knowledge of that one, the Alabama Highway one. It's just he claims it was someone else doing the shooting. And since he waived his rights and agreed to speak, why on earth would the cops not speak to him, not lock him into a statement? And better yet, record it. The homicide case was clearly a priority, but aggravated assault is still a serious violent crime, and I don't understand why the police would have decided not to investigate it when they had the suspect sitting right there in front of them, happy to talk.
Claire didn't understand it either, so she went to talk to the prosecutor at Heath's trial to try and figure out if maybe she remembered why the interrogation was dropped, even though Heath had agreed to it.
Then the other thing was I wanted to talk with Martha Jacobs. She is the DA who tried the Heath Wilson case, and she said it was a 3-day trial. She got that by looking on her computer. She hardly remembers anything from the trial. She had small kids at the time. She was the only prosecutor in the courtroom. They assigned a second prosecutor shortly thereafter, so she was having just trials all over the place, and she just doesn't remember much about it at all. She thinks it was routine for them to take a waiver, Miranda rights waiver, but not then interrogate. However, they did seem to think it'd be odd that there's no notation that he waived his rights and then refused to talk or lawyered up or something. Like, it doesn't make sense that he would waive his rights and agree to talk and then not talk and there not be any notation of it. So they didn't come out and say that was strange, but they kept looking for further stuff in the file. I keep saying they because Lee Patterson was in the room for much of the time, but I was really talking with Martha Jacobs. She didn't remember anything about the 911 call. She doesn't even have any independent recollection of whether the witnesses testified. I think that's it. Lee Patterson does not like the George Innocence Project. She told me several times that she doesn't like the George Innocence Project. She told me she's very upset that we are looking into this case. Poor Stanley Sutton. He's in a nursing home and he can't defend himself. And we just took advantage of that opportunity to bring the case forward now. And I kind of made a face like, that's not right. And she basically said, yeah, the defendant's family was saying that. She says that she knows he's guilty and she knows he did it because she's the lawyer who handled the appeal in the case. So she is not by any means, I mean, she's cooperative enough. She's just not on our side. So on Georgia Innocence Project's side.
As for Heath's trial, there are no firm conclusions that can be drawn from the supposed lack of interrogation or the questions about whether or not GSR testing was done. Still, I wish Joey's attorneys had used these troubling questions in the same way Heath's attorney did in his closing arguments.
Lack of evidence is not a red herring. It's an issue for you to utilize in determining whether or not there is proof beyond a reasonable doubt and to the exclusion of every other reasonable hypothesis, except the guilt of my client, Heath Wilson.
But lack of evidence isn't positive evidence either. And that's why the Heath Wilson issue is so confounding in Joey's case. Because Heath Wilson was so quickly ruled out on the basis of evidence that doesn't seem robust enough to support the state's conclusion, no real investigation was ever done. Which means, for the most part, we're left with the strange coincidence of a car that looks like Heath's being involved in two shootings on the same night.
I try not to be, you know, me of all people, I try not to be closed-minded and I try to be open. Because I don't want the wrong person locked up for this. Because, you know, I've been down all this time and don't know nothing about it. So I don't want to push and get the wrong guy locked up. But it's just, you know, I mean, it's just, all this is just, I mean, you figure if the call logs, because back when all this happened, they were saying 7:15.
All right, they say all kinds of stuff.
Right. So if you figure, you said it takes, 11 minutes to get...
I don't know. Cause we can't even do the test again because the roads are all changed.
But if you say 11 to 12 minutes, then all these discrepancies in time, that gives him plenty of time to get from point A to point B. And what are the coincidences? What's the chances of this happening in the same night, the same car, the same description?
What are the chances you'd pass by where Isaac had wrecked?
That's true, too.
Even if all the timing issues fell away, and we could prove conclusively that Heath could have been on Highway 27 South that night, that's very different from having evidence that shows that he actually was. Still, there's at least one piece of evidence we do have to consider. Even though Detective Moser ruled out Heath almost immediately, his interview with Tracy Dunn wasn't the last time Heath's possible links to the Dawkins case were investigated. 1 year later, on March 23, 2001, Stanley Sutton went and interviewed Heath Wilson himself. This wasn't related to the Alabama highway shooting, though. Sutton wasn't involved with that. This interview was just for the Dawkins case. And last year, when the full police files in this case were shown to a defense attorney for the first time, Sutton's notes of this interview were in there. Here's what they said.
Friday, 1200 hours. Investigator Sutton talked with Heath Wilson, Pinecrest Drive, in reference to Isaac Dawkins. He stated he was on 27 South. He didn't shoot Isaac. He doesn't know Isaac or the two suspects.
Heath was on 27 South, according to Sutton. Heath denied being involved in shooting Isaac, but according to Sutton's notes, Heath did acknowledge being on the same highway as Isaac that night. When, where, or why? Sutton's notes didn't record that, so they leave a lot of unanswered questions. But the biggest questions are this. Why did Sutton write down that Heath said he was on 27 South that night, and why didn't Sutton tell anyone else about it? We've been asked quite a bit about why we believe with a fair amount of certainty that Joey Watkins is innocent. Well, other than the incredible discrepancies in the state's case and the flimsy evidence they base it on, there's something kind of major that everyone missed. In kind of an amazing plot twist, the same evidence that Susan Simpson proved could not be used as evidence of guilt against Adnan Syed may be the same evidence that actually proves that Joey couldn't have killed Isaac. The cell phone records. Next time on Undisclosed.
And that wraps up episode 20 of the second season of Undisclosed. All right, folks, let's thank everyone who helped to put this podcast on. As always, our most special thanks go to the folks at the Georgia Innocence Project. Very cool of GIP to sponsor this week's episode. Make sure you visit their website at www.georgiainnocenceproject.org to learn a little something about wrongful convictions in Georgia. Hey, and don't forget, text Joey to 91999 in order to get a link that allows you to donate to the Georgia Innocence Project to help them continue their work in overturning wrongful convictions in Georgia. While we're here thanking our sponsors, we also want to make sure to thank Stamps.com. Stamps, you have stuck with us for a long time, and we cannot thank you enough for your continued support of our podcast. Rebecca Lavoie of the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories. She produces this show, and she gets help from Hannah McCarthy and Brooke Giddings of the Actual Innocence podcast. Methil Telhan is the super producer that keeps this train on the tracks. Thanks for everything you continue to do, Methil. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez did our theme music. Baluki did our logo. Christy Williams and Nina Mooser did the website. On that website, you can link to our social media accounts. You can check us out on our Facebook, Twitter, Instagram accounts using the handle at UndisclosedPod. Send us a message using the hashtag Undisclosed, hashtag Justice for Joey. Or if you want to ask Mr. John Cryer of the Undisclosed Addendum a question, you can tweet at him at Mr. John Cryer using the hashtag UDAddendum. Maybe, just maybe, he'll read your question on his show that drops every Thursday at 6 p.m. EST. Lastly, and leastly, your executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to seeing you next week for another episode. Until then.
We've got a special treat for our listeners now, an original piece by the Walker Faith and Character-based State Prison's Variety Band. That's right, it's Joey Watkins' band. The name of the song is Changes. And you're going to hear Joseph Watkins on guitar, Chris Meyer on backup vocals and lead guitar, Frankie Flynn with lead vocals and drums, James Kubicek rhythm guitar and backup vocals, and Greg Smith on the bass guitar. Enjoy.
I'll be alright.